From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. For today's episode, we are digging into an issue that doesn't really get a lot of attention. Of course, we're always trying to find new ways to talk about North Korea here at KEI. And for this episode, we're going to be talking about North Korea's healthcare system. So my guest today is an expert in healthcare research, Dr. John Grundy. He recently wrote a report for KEI called History, International Relations, and Public Health, The Case of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, 1953 to 2015. And in it, he looks into some of the changes in the North Korean healthcare system, how it has developed since the Korean War, and what are some of the shortcomings that they find today. So it was a very interesting conversation. I was really glad to be able to talk to Dr. Grundy over Skype. So with that in mind, let's get right to the conversation. So before we get started, I just want to really thank you for taking your time and for your really fascinating article. It was something that is really important, but I never see anything about really. So thank you so much for writing for us.
Yeah, no, thanks, Jenna. Pleasure.
One thing I noticed that in your article, you looked at North Korea's public health services from after the Korean War all the way up until present day. Can you give us some of the major highlights and turning points in this history and how the health infrastructure looks today?
Yeah. Well, I guess the major turning points, just in brief, following the Korean War and then the establishment of the Kim Il-sung regime in the north, basically, the socialist philosophy governed the design, the initial design of the healthcare system. So, you know, the establishment of the network of facilities going right down to the section level, below the county level to the section, the high emphasis on placement of rural doctors in the countryside. It meant that they had a basically a socialistic healthcare system from very early on. So that was the first major turning point. And then with the assistance of basically the Soviet group of countries, they were able to develop their primary healthcare system quite effectively. But from the 1980s, and particularly in the 1990s, when there was economic decline and then a cut off of the subsidies from the Soviet Union, then the country experienced the well-known food shortages. And then with the introduction of the nuclear programs in the 1990s and the introduction of rigorous sanctions. So from the 1990s, the socialist health system has been retained, but the logistical and operational support to run that system went into a sharp decline. So what we saw in the mid-1990s are major collapses in healthcare coverage for priority interventions such as immunisation, maternal and child health, communicable disease control, and on top of that, the impact of famine and infrastructure decline. So it was a complete disaster, really. The next major turning point, I think, was in the early 2000s, and that's when UN agencies and NGOs even a bit earlier, started to become, into partnership with the DPRK government. And we've seen a sort of minor turnaround in healthcare outcomes. So immunisation, TB control, malaria control, some aspects of women's and children's health have there's been some slight improvements in the early 2000s. So now the system's more or less frozen in that status whereby the socialist health system is in place, but there's some severe shortages of logistics, infrastructure, essential medicines that's still really impacting on the quality of healthcare coverage.
Going along with that, the socialist mindset, you also mentioned that ideology and political relations have been the dominant forces in the evolution of the healthcare system and of population health in the DPRK.
Mm.
Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, I think. So on the domestic side, the Juche philosophy and the self-reliance philosophy has meant that there's been a strong national emphasis on defence expenditures. So I think the general estimates are that 25% of the GDP is invested in the military, and there's over a standing army of over 1 million men and women, so out of a population of 23 million. So heavy emphasis on security and defence, which I think has attracted finance away from essential social services such as health. And the doctrine of self-reliance means that the seeking out of international partnerships are quite limited, and international exchanges. So the health workforce has become somewhat isolated, although there are some important exceptions to that, which maybe we could discuss a bit later. So that's the domestic side. And then on the international side, as is well known, the DPRK is surrounded by what they perceive to be hostile forces: China, Russia, Japan, South Korea, US. So they're strategically isolated, and the international forces have almost exclusively emphasised in their international discourse the nuclear issue and national security. But the story of human security, in other words, the basic needs of North Korean families, are not in the international discourse. They're not in the discussion. So basically, the population internationally has been locked out of the discourse, and it's all about rival states and their negotiation of power arrangements, particularly around the nuclear issue. So I would say there are domestic forces and international relations forces which are isolating the North Korean population.
Right. And I know this plays into my next question as well, this isolation, that it's really difficult for researchers to have full and reliable information. And also for the healthcare workers who are there on the ground, they don't necessarily have the same level of information they would in many other parts of the world. So can you speak a little bit to that? How do you as a researcher get reliable information about the public healthcare system in North Korea? And then also, how do these healthcare workers work when they can't necessarily share information as easily?
Yes, well, of course, it's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, I suppose the only way around it is observation and direct negotiation and discussion. It's true that between various, I'm not sure about levels of government, but certainly between the government and the international community, there's very little sharing of information by government officials with international or NGO representatives. But there are plenty of opportunities, if you go there, to sit down and discuss and talk and observe. I did have opportunities in, I forget the exact year, might have been 2011, as part of the evaluation of the Republic of Korea's investment in health, to actually randomly select facilities and go to areas that are not necessarily controlled by government officials. So it is possible to have some open dialogue in North Korea. It's not impossible. Also, sharing of health data and health information. Although documents aren't handed over to international officials, by and large, it is possible still to have open and frank discussions with North Korean officials. So I think it's overblown to say that you can't get any information out of North Korea. It's just a question of the quality of the dialogue. If the dialogue is respectful, information can be exchanged verbally and by observation. But I would agree with you that it's still very difficult to obtain published health data in the DPRK context. But I would certainly argue, based on my own experience, that it's entirely possible to have open dialogue with DPRK health officials on the health situation there.
So can you give us a little bit more information? What are some of the particular health challenges that North Korea is facing now? And is there any solutions that you might have found during your research?
Yeah, well, I think just going back to my early discussion about the structure of the system, I mean, if you compare it, say, with countries like Myanmar, Cambodia, and to a certain extent even Vietnam, that the system is very human resource intense. So there are doctors located in community neighbourhoods right across the country, and there are facilities strategically located. So in terms of the actual numbers of people and buildings that make up a healthcare system, from the health centres right up to the hospitals, it's all there. But what's not there are the commodities that need to run through a system to enable it to be accessed to the population. So by those sort of commodities, I mean essential medicines, referral transport, blood transfusion facilities, laboratory facilities, and all these are absolutely critical to the functioning of a healthcare system. So those commodities are not in place due to domestic priority setting, i.e. the high defence expenditures, and internationally, the system of isolation and sanctions. So basically, the system is there, but the movement of commodities, operational finance and people between the levels of the system is frozen due to resource depletion. So it's a very tough situation. But what I observed is where there are partnerships with international agencies in particular, and there are targeted investments to improve the system, then what you see is reduced mortality and much improved access by the population. So we saw cases where, you know, maternal deaths were caused simply by the fact that the basic equipment, such as a giving set to give a transfusion, is not available. So it's very simple supply of essential life-saving commodities that are just not adequately provided in the system. But where they have been provided in the system, for example, vaccines or essential maternal child healthcare equipment, malaria interventions, TB interventions, what we see is improved coverage and reduced mortality. So that means things can be done if the key players want to do it.
So you referenced this a little bit earlier, but we are also operating under a time period, a situation where there's a lot of increased pressure. There are sanctions being placed, increasingly tough sanctions being placed on the North Koreans because of their nuclear and missile provocations. So how does one work, either as a researcher or as a healthcare worker, within this context? And how can the sanctions, you know, is it playing a role of, you know, making things more difficult for people who are just trying to help those on the ground? How do you deal with that context?
Yeah, I think the opportunity for the population in DPRK, and I think also the population in the Republic of Korea and the global concerned community, is that if you have a partner with the DPRK state that can work to make tangible improvements for the population, then I think it's a good road to take. So the difficulty is state-to-state relations, because they're so strained with, you know, the regional governments and governments internationally. State-to-state is very difficult. But there are health partnerships that are not governed by states that enable civil partnerships, if you like, to take place. So examples are the Global Fund to Fight TB, Malaria and AIDS, and the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunisation. So both of those groups are international public-private partnerships. So they're not constrained as much by conflicts between states. Their goal is to work with governments to improve health and human security. So that they have an ability to work around the politics, the international politics of international relations, to work around it, to provide some relief to the population. But this is not to say they're not affected, because what the sanctions do is they prevent North Koreans from engaging internationally, leaving the country and attending various technical meetings and conferences. But they can also affect the flow of operational funds for the health system. And I can't be 100% sure, but my experience was that the sanctions do have an impact in some cases on the flow of health commodities into the country. So the question, I think, comes around to this for international observers. Is our dialogue with DPRK and the type of discourse we have completely governed by state-to-state relations? Or do we have a conceptual framework that enables us to work in partnership with the government to improve the human security of the population? So becoming more population-focused instead of state-focused in our thinking. I think that's the only way we get around this stalemate that we're in.
Okay, great. As I said, this is a really important issue, and I think it's not really discussed very often, unfortunately. So I do really appreciate your insights. Before we get going, is there anything else that you think it's important for us to know? Any other closing thoughts?
Yeah, I think in terms of closing thoughts, I think people in the Republic of Korea must feel it very strongly because of they have family relations, etc. But I think, based on my 8 or 9 or 10 journeys or whatever it is to DPRK, I think the thing that came through really strongly to me is the personal contact you establish with people there helps to overcome the stereotyping of the North Korean state that we see through the global media. The stereotype of officials, stereotype of the military, the stereotype of the mass parades. But I think what's missing in our discourse in North Korea is the stereotyping of normal families, grandfathers, grandmothers, fathers, mothers, children. They're just the same as all of us, and so they have the same right to healthcare and education and food security as anyone on this planet. And so that discussion about the ordinary lives of North Koreans beyond the politics, beyond the prison camps, but into the, homes, houses, farms. I mean, there needs to be more feeling for how ordinary people live. And I think that's completely missing in the international discussion.
Yeah, I really agree with you there. So I'll leave it at that. I think that's a great closing thought. I really want to thank you again for your time and for your great research for KEI.
Yeah, thanks, Jenna.
Thank you, everyone, for once again joining us here on Korean Context. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. As always, please remember to subscribe to our podcasts and also subscribe to KEI's content on Twitter and Facebook. You can find us by searching Korea Econ Inst on Twitter, and by searching for the Korea Economic Institute on Facebook. We also have a YouTube page and an Instagram, so be sure to check those out as well. And definitely come back next week for another great episode.